So, I'm here with Jeremy Constant, who is first chair violinist?
I'm assistant concertmaster in San Francisco, concertmaster in Marin, concertmaster in Sun Valley, Idaho. Concertmaster is first chair. Assistant can be anywhere from second to four. In San Francisco, I'm number four.
Okay. Of the San Francisco Symphony.
San Francisco Symphony. Marin Symphony and Sun Valley Summer Symphony.
Okay. This is how you do the scheduling. That was the next question.
Yeah.
So, okay, this is not a predictable career path, right?
No, it's kind of a find-your-own-way career path.
So how did you end up? I mean, that's the first question, is how did you end up? It's not the easiest career. There's no clear way that you can just follow it and you end up in the right place. How did you end up playing violin for a career?
Music lessons were considered part of our education when we were growing up.
Okay.
So all of the kids in my family got music lessons. And part of that, I played violin. So it's clearly one of the instruments that plays in an orchestra. So when you're learning violin, you sort of learn all of your solo stuff. And then if you've got a smart teacher, he or she will also get you very quickly involved in playing with other people. Because just sitting around isolated in a practice room isn't terribly engaging for a kid.
But was this something when you first started doing it, you went, I love this, I can't get enough of this, I can't practice enough, I just don't...
No. No, my parents tell me I asked to play the violin when I was six. They weren't sure I even knew what a violin was, so they put on a record and said, which one's the violin? And I correctly identified it. Then they took me to the local violin teacher who said, and now nowadays this will sound laughable, at 6 years old, she said, he's too young. Get him piano lessons for a year, and if when he's seven he wants to take violin lessons, bring him back. Nowadays they're starting kids at three, which I'm not sure how I feel about that, but it seems to be working out okay.
So I played
piano for a year, then still wanted to play the violin, was playing the violin, then played some duets with other students, really liked that. Then some quartets, started getting into the chamber music thing, really liked that.
At like eight or nine?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the sooner you start that stuff, the better off you are, because it's splitting the brain. First of all, the big challenge is, okay, I'm out of tune, so you pay attention to your left hand and your right hand goes to hell. And it's like, oh my God, I'm not making a good sound. So you pay attention to your right hand, and you're playing all out of tune. So it's all about splitting your brain. Like playing a lot of people have played the piano, and it's like you practice the left hand first, and then you practice the right hand first, and then you think, how the heck am I going to put these two together? So the more people you play with, the more ways you're splitting your brain. You want to be sending your awareness. You want to be so solid in what you're doing that you can send your awareness out to what the other people are doing so that you and they can respond. And it becomes a communications medium. So after chamber music, I got hooked up with the local youth orchestra.
At age?
I probably started that when I was 11 or 12. And I was really fortunate in that in this nowhere nothing town.
Which was where? You grew up in Canada.
Waterloo, Ontario. It was one of those infamous split towns where there was the Uniroyal factory and the University of Waterloo. And so there are a fair number of towns like that all over the world where... There's two big things. There's the academic community and the non-academic community. And there's always a tension there. But this community had a very active classical music scene. Very small, but very good. My youth orchestra conductor was a retired bass player who used to be the principal bass under Thomas Beecham in London. one of the great orchestras of the world during one of the great eras in their history, and this guy is my youth orchestra conductor. So I learned very, very well from him. And then I was invited to play in the adult orchestra, which again was one of these remarkable orchestras, and still is, where some not so great players, but some absolutely phenomenal players. Our concertmaster was Irving Ilmer, who used to play in the Chicago Symphony, used to play in the Fine Arts Quartet. He was a big hitter in his day, and decided to do this as a form of retirement and giving back, and knew the conductor. And the conductor was one of these guys. He had been trained in Vienna, and after 5 or 6 years, he had, somebody asked, "Well, Raffi, what are you doing conducting here? Why aren't you globetrotting?" And his response was very telling. He said, "Well, anybody can make a career hopping from town to town being a guest conductor, but building an orchestra in a community that didn't have one before, that's real." And I remember that to this day. It was really remarkable. So when I was playing in the orchestra, it was one of those things where your jaw hits the floor. You're overwhelmed by what it is you have to do. It's remarkably difficult. But at the same time, you are part of this huge thing that's making this unbelievable sound, and there's no way you can do that on your own. That's the only way you can get back. I hated practicing, but loved performing, and hated the idea of sounding bad in public. So it was, the great motivators in life, joy and fear. This was, this was both of them. So I practiced enough that I didn't totally embarrass myself on stage.
But was it, okay, so now you're 12, you're playing in this orchestra, the sound is amazing. Is that
I have to do
this in
Absolutely.
My life? This is yeah. I'm home?
Absolutely. It was violin playing. I was lazy. And I could afford to be lazy in one sense, in that it came reasonably easily to me. Having something that comes that easily to me and having it be a source of that much enjoyment, it's like, why wouldn't you want to do that for a living? When I found out, hey, you can make a living doing this, yeah, you do that.
Okay. So, you love it, you're good at it, you don't have to work particularly hard.
Well, it came easily. It came easily in the playing and the participating. And I knew I wanted to get good at it. Then I went to school and became disillusioned just with the people, my fellow students, in a lot of ways. But that was part of the culture of the school at the time.
What school?
Juilliard.
Oh, Juilliard.
Juilliard.
Okay.
And at the time, I don't know what it's like now, but it was, you're there to be great, become great soloist. And I had endless arguments with my classmates, all of whom were like beavering away for this competition or that competition. And they would all blow off orchestra. Oh, orchestra's beneath me. Even my teacher says so. And there was this disdain for it was sort of viewed as the last resort, playing in an orchestra. So I asked these guys, name the greatest number of soloists you can. And I think the best person came up with 15. And, I was astonished. I hadn't heard of three quarters of them. But they came up with 15. I said, okay, how many people are in our class at Juilliard? How many people do you think will be on that list of people you can name? what do you think you're going to do for a living? And the others who were like beavering away on competitions, I said, okay, what's the prize money? They said, oh, it's, you know, $7,000. You know, I won a competition back then with them, got $10,000. It's like, yeah. And, you know, once you do that, you go, okay, how many performances am I guaranteed? 4, 5 in that first year. Then what? Okay, why not take that time and go to orchestra and get good at playing and learn the repertoire? Because the second, third, fourth time through with the repertoire, it's way easier. First time through, you are scrambling to keep up. Even though you're trying to make a big show of how good you are, you're scrambling to keep up.
Yeah.
And I said, so look at these jobs that are available. They advertise in the union paper. You know, all of the major orchestras advertise. They're trying to get people to come to auditions. Here's what we pay. It's a tenure track job. If you're good enough to win the audition and good enough over a long enough period of time to get tenure, you have job security. And it pays pretty well. And, oh, by the way, there's 500 people applying each time.
For each job.
For each job. So you have to be good just to get in the door. Why don't you spend your time getting good at something that at least has some possibility of a good job at the end of it? And this was lost on a lot of my colleagues. And there are a number of people in orchestras. Not a lot nowadays, but the ones that came up when I came up through school systems that were doing that much of a disservice for their students, where you can tell that they feel like they didn't achieve what they wanted in life, even though they've got a phenomenal job that people would kill for.
You mean playing in an orchestra?
Yeah. They bought... They drank that Kool-Aid that was beneath them. And it's a real shame because it's a wonderful way to make a living. Here's the real challenge that nobody tells you about when you're, even when you're embracing the notion of, for a violinist or for any of the string players, when you're embracing the notion of, this is what I want to do, you've spent your formative years basically in isolation. In a practice room, honing your ability to convey your voice. And the job is suspending all of that and finding that incredibly elusive balance between contributing and not sticking out. And it's a completely different, not only different skill set, it's a completely different mental state, and it is not necessarily compatible with why you went into the business.
So how do you feel about that? I mean, you've now been doing this, how long have you been playing in an orchestra? I mean, as a professional?
My first big gig was, I got into the San Francisco Opera in 1980, and we're in it, so 30 years. Yikes!
Okay, so beyond the scary 30 years, which means you weren't 6 when you did that, so how do you feel about that? Like, do you still feel a frustration of not being able to be completely creative and speak with your full voice?
That's why I pursued being concertmaster in other orchestras. For the vast majority of my colleagues in San Francisco, that is the only thing they do. It's at their physical limits. Because it's physically very taxing.
If you were to say, looking back, so now you've been doing this 30 years,
mm-hmm.
What's your creative satisfaction? Like, would you do things differently? Would you do them the same? Was it worth it?
A lot of why I went into flying was dealing with the reality that if I am looking to my art to be my only source of satisfaction, I'm ceding control over my emotional state to other people. And I was not willing to do that, ultimately. So the flying a large portion of why I pursued it and what I love about it is pilot in command means pilot in command. And there are consequences. Very, very real consequences. Now, there are consequences to what I do in my music. It impacts people, hopefully positively. But it is a very much a large collaborative effort. It's like making a mosaic with 100 different people rather than being the painter. So flying is an outlet for absolute control that I think many of us crave on a certain level. It's whether or not we've got the guts to actually pursue it. Most people, I think, want it. I'm not sure everybody is willing to do what's necessary to get it.
So you're in the symphony. That's more satisfying. How the heck does flying come into it? I mean, do you have pilots in the family?
Well,
wander out to the airport one day? I mean, that's not an obvious leap.
No, it isn't.
For a violinist in the symphony.
My wife teases Lee mercilessly. Whenever I hear an airplane, look, there's an airplane, like it's some miracle. It's always been like that, you know. I've always thought that was something incredibly cool.
Even in Canada, as a kid, growing up.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But never thought about pursuing that instead of music.
No. It was admiring from afar. I had no idea what the realities were. Hadn't been exposed to it. Didn't know you could, you know, be a kid knocking around wash planes, pump gas, and earn some money for a lesson. Like, that wasn't part of the universe for me.
So part of it's exposure. You were exposed to music, you were not exposed to aviation.
Yes, yeah.
Not necessarily that aviation could satisfy you professionally, I mean...
But it would have been... I think that aviation is one of those things, like music, where the early... Like so many things, where the earlier you do it, the better at it you get. The learning comes more easily, and it sticks longer. Like languages.
Right.
I think any early learning is going to be much deeper. And quicker, more quickly acquired, and greater longevity to the learning. I would have loved to have learned to fly gliders first. But, you know, it was one of those things where we had, you know, living in the Bay Area, you know, you have to buy as good an instrument as you can, and, well, that's the cost of a house. And then it'd be nice to live somewhere, so that's the cost of a house. So it took a long time before there was any excess cash.
So you start taking flying lessons. I mean, is that, and clearly it's got, that was 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, and you're building an airplane. I mean, where do you go from flying lessons, which gave you the control? Was that the big thing? Was it gives you a sense of control?
Yeah, that was what I was missing at work. Was the this is me. This really is all about, you know, all performers want to think, this is all about me. Well, when you're pilot in command, nobody else in there, it really is all about you. So you can be totally non-irritating to the people around you because there's nobody around you and still get your satisfaction. You know, so it's a socially acceptable way of having it be all about you. So what happened was that gave me back my sense of control that I felt I was sort of not getting enough of at work. Probably says some really horrifying things about my personality type, but...
Well, you know, actually, pilots as a group, this is what I was saying the other night, they've done PhD psychology studies, are certified control freaks. I mean, that is the appeal. If you're not into control, you have no desire to learn to fly.
And learning to fly was the first time I would say I was actually what I would call a good student, where I actually studied hard, paid really close attention. You know, there's something very focusing about having it matter in a very flesh and bone kind of matter.
Even though going on stage or and failing horribly is a death you have to live with,
mm-hmm. you can live with
it. You can live with it. Yeah. There is something very different about, and then that's the end.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, and I enjoyed the studying of it on a lot of different levels. I enjoyed the subject. I enjoyed what was going to be the result. I enjoyed the totally different world it put me in mentally, both the learning about it and the doing it, because you can't be thinking about work. And I was getting into terrible, you know, cyclical stuff, and it was totally, you know, self-destructive and not good.
Did that surprise you? That element of it, of taking yourself out of work and clearing your mind that way, or did you sort of think it would?
I hoped it would. I didn't know whether it was a naive hope, because it was something I hadn't done. But I was very pleased that it did do that. I like to have refuge.
And is the music a refuge from too much pilot, or is it really that the piloting is a refuge from that?
I've been doing music, let's see, how old am I? That would make it 45 years I've been playing the violin. It is, you know, through various stages in life we have crises, and one of them for me was when I got injured the first time. And it was devastating emotionally, and I could not figure out why. You know,
injured, it's just by playing the violin.
Yeah, yeah. You know, various tendonitises and impingements and things like that, and you never know whether you're going to recover. Some people don't. I've had probably 8 to 10 colleagues who were gone, long gone, due to injuries. But I you know, in trying to figure out why I was such a basket case, I realized that being a violinist isn't what I did, it was who I was. You know, from the time you're 8 years old, that is your source of validation. Doesn't matter how bad you are at this or how you've screwed up that, at least you're getting recognition as a violinist. That's your source it's your validation. It's who you are, and it very quickly becomes, if nothing else, at least I'm that. And at the first prospect of that, the first real prospect of that not being what I did, it was, well, what am I good for? And, you know, for somebody who's, you know, let's face it, all performers are basically egomaniacs. So for somebody who's basically an egomaniac to go, okay, well, that's not available to you anymore, what are you good for? And that was a scary thing to think about. And so that's when I decided I needed another life. You know, I needed other pursuits that were sources of satisfaction, engagement, challenge. You know, so that when I can't do those, it's like, well, now what are you good for?
But your identity is not linked to one thing.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Does it help you have an identity that is more centered, so that these are things that you do? You're not...
Yes.
It's not like if you couldn't fly and you couldn't have music, you would be as lost, because you...
Yeah, I've got other... I know I've done something extraordinarily challenging that wasn't music and had some success at it. So some of it is dealing with challenge. Can you?
So what would you, I mean, we talked about this a little earlier. What would you say to somebody who said, I love music, I love playing the cello, the violin, the whatever, the mm-hmm. drums, the bass,
Mm-hmm.
Should I try to make this a living or shouldn't I? I mean, what would you tell them, knowing that it's hard, it's about doubt, it's about uncertainty, you're going to lose a lot of auditions, it's going to be very hard to make a living. There is a certain amount of luck that goes into, on that day, were you playing well enough to make the audition?
Huge amounts of luck. Huge amounts of luck. So the question is, what is it about music that you love, that you want to do? Is doing it for a living as important to you as just simply doing it? Because there are lots and lots of opportunities to do great music and not have it be your sole source of income.
Right. So, but what would you say to somebody who says, yes, this is, it is
then
the
you
thing
have no
that
choice.
I want to do.
Then you have no choice. If you have no choice, then it's, there's no choice. If you have a choice, keep your options open as long as possible. You can always take auditions. And if you should happen to be successful, you can then decide to drop the other thing you're pursuing. But if you're not, you're still pursuing that other thing.
So for you, were you in the camp of there was no choice, this was the thing?
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it was easy for me. It was shut your eyes, plug your nose, and jump in. Because I'm not doing anything else. I made that decision early.
From the gut.
Yeah.
Not in the mind, but from the gut.
Yeah.
Because, one of the questions is, are you crazy to pick a tough class, a tough course, career path, or is it not really that you're picking a tough path, it's the only option you have, and it happens to be tough.
It's the only option I wanted.
So what is your, in both of these worlds, the music world, which is a passion-driven thing, if you don't have passion, partly because they're both hard, and so if mm-hmm. you're not passionate on some level, mm-hmm. you walk away. It's a self-selecting thing.
You could call it passion, but after doing it for so long, it's also, it's about pride in what you're doing. It's about endurance. It's about personal standards. So the passion can easily be over-romanticized. And when you're doing it for a living, or thinking about doing it for a living, you need to not romanticize it. For the audience, great. Romanticize it all you want. But the reality of doing it, it's craft and professionalism, endurance, having high standards, and protecting those standards.
Where does the endurance come from? Do you think some people are born with it, or is that a decision you make?
I think everybody's different. Some people have it. Some people develop it when they see the need, and some people can't, and you will never know.
But the people who have it may come from a passion for something gives you the endurance, like you care about it enough for you.
Certainly. Caring is very important. It's easy to stop caring about something that you do for so long, and I don't care what the endeavor is and how cool it may be to others. Keeping caring about it is harder than it may appear, but it's critical to keeping the standards up. And I think one of the things that helps with that is the esprit de corps. You don't want to let your colleagues down. You don't want them to be the target of a bad review. Public, being held up to public ridicule, which is what we expose ourselves to day in and day out, you don't want that to be because of something you did. And they'll never know. The audience will never know that they screwed up because of something you did.
Right. So there's something beyond. There's a passion within you for something that makes you want to do it, that says, I know this road is hard, but I want to do it. But to keep doing it for
it's a different
over
challenge.
A career is, there are other things that come into play besides your personal passion for it.
The challenges evolve. And they're all every day they're changing.
Particular way that they evolve, or you just think for everybody it's different?
Sure. I mean, if you look at baseball players, you know, the young hotshot 100-mile-an-hour pitchers, okay, what do they, how do they deal with, you know, a little bit of their stuff going away as their career goes on? Some don't. Some don't learn how to throw a slider. All they got's heat. And once the batters figure out what the timing is, they're screwed unless they've got something else. So they have to evolve. Can they come back after an injury? What if they're sitting, you know, playing on a team with a butthead, you know, who's got real problems in the dugout and is, you know, always getting arrested? You know, like, what do you do? How do you deal with that? How do you deal with the distractions? How do you deal with a manager that you disagree with and you think you're losing because the man, you know, there are all, every industry has this. To do anything for that long, whether you loved it at first or just stumbled into it, to do it for that long, the challenges evolve day after day after day.
And what is it, and you probably can only speak for yourself, but I mean, what is it that keeps you wanting to solve those evolving challenges?
I like a challenge. Sometimes I'd wish they'd go away, but I like a challenge.
But I mean, it is. It's not like you do it and do this and it's on the shelf and then you just live your career.
Intellectual curiosity, musical curiosity, curiosity about other people, what they do. And I mean, you've got, you know, it's like...
But there's decisions I make every day. I mean, in keeping doing what I do, you know, about is it worth to keep doing it? If it's not fun anymore, does that mean I need to go do something different? Or does that mean that I need to change how I do what I'm doing? I mean, there's a decision, there's a deep decision I've made that writing is so important to me that it's what I should be doing. Mm-hmm. It feels like home when I do it. Mm-hmm. And so I've got to figure out a way to keep that going.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it's a marathon, right? Because it's a career.
And you never know, and you're given the beginning of the course. You're not told how long the course is or what mountains or valleys there may be in front of you.
Right.
You have no idea.
And if I was not that clear about how much that feeds me and how much I want to do mm-hmm. that, this would be way too hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go get a job.
Yep.
So for me, it's that clarity at the core. I have that one compass direction that I know is I'm... How I get there, I don't know, but I know mm-hmm. that, you know, the horizon is there, the sun is there, and that's where I'm headed.
Mm-hmm.
And that point of light that directs a painting, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm very clear about that. And mm-hmm. and that, to me, is sort of a passion, not in an intense way, mm-hmm. but it's a deep, long-term,
mm-hmm.
you know.
I think that we all wish the road were flat and straight. And whenever it starts deviating, we start questioning, why the heck am I doing this? But it's life. I mean, it's when it sucks, it sucks. The question is, how quickly do you want to make a change? Is it right to make a change? And there is no... I think ultimately we have to get comfortable with total ambiguity. There ain't no right answer. And when we...
To do this kind of thing.
To do anything. To do it... If the more comfortable we are with ambiguous situations and ambiguous results and not being able to say, absolutely, that was the right thing. I think, you know, there are people who take the safe road. And it's probably right for them. There aren't that many safe roads available.
And was it worth it? 7.5 years? 7 years?
The knowledge that I have now was hard won. And it is so different than the pursuit of knowledge that I had engaged in for 40 years previously, that it's very gratifying. Now, if you phrase the question, knowing what you know now, would you have done it again? I have no idea. But I'm grateful I did it.
So, do you look at the music and say, you know, in these moments, the hard path was worth it, this was so worth it? Or do you just know it was worth it?
I'm just grateful, hugely grateful to have this kind of job, knowing what the other options are. I consider myself very lucky. And it's a job, when I do that and all of the stuff I do, that yields enough excess money that I can do the aviation thing.
To keep yourself sane.
To keep myself sane. Yeah, you know, there is that. Yeah, maybe I wouldn't be so nuts if I didn't do so much. Yeah.
But it is, I mean, for all of the, yes, it's hard and the challenges change and all that.
Absolutely.
If you had it to do over again.
Sure. If I would have
it's
this,
not a question.
If I would have this success,
even if you knew what you know now, you would
yes.
do it again.
Yeah, yeah. If this was the result, absolutely. Sorry.
But it's ambiguous. You don't get to know.
Absolutely,
but if you
don't.
Go back, you would do it again.
I wouldn't have a choice. I made the choices I made because that's what I wanted.